So the title is the Scottish Reformation of 1560, and that's 450 years of blessing for Scotland. Now, I've been asked to give two talks, the first one on the Scottish Reformation and the second one on John Knox, and these two obviously have a considerable overlap. And so to try and keep them distinct, I'm going to treat this subject with a before and after approach. So what was Scotland like before the Reformation, what was it like after? And then the John Knox one will be a bit more chronological, God willing. So this is a before and after. So I wanted to first of all describe Scotland before the Reformation. Secondly, say something about the events leading to the Reformation. And then thirdly, Scotland transformed by the Reformation. Firstly, Scotland before the Reformation. Secondly, the events leading to it. So a bit of history there, as it were, chronology. And then thirdly, Scotland transformed by the Reformation. So firstly, what was Scotland like before the Reformation? Well, the best book on this subject is a book by the historian David Hay Fleming, which is the Reformation in Scotland, from which I've taken a lot of the information. He does a pretty thorough description of the religious state of Scotland, of the dire religious state of Scotland at that time. And the first point to make is that Scotland before the Reformation was a country dominated by the Roman Church. And there is a good way and a bad way in which a country could be dominated by a church. It's good for a country to be religious. It's not good for a country to be secular, as our country is so much at this time. And we believe in the establishment principle, so we think that there should be an established church, and that religion should be prominent and should permeate society. So, for instance, it used to be the case that schools and university lectures would begin with prayer. That was a statute at Aberdeen University, which only abolished fairly recently, I think. Well, we would think that's a good thing. So when we're saying that Scotland was dominated by the church, we're not critical of that sort of thing at all, because Christ is to be honoured in every sphere of life. But the way in which the Roman Church dominated Scotland, and also England, was different. It was by owning a vast proportion of the land and the wealth. And if any of you have been to, well, Italy, for instance, every nice place you look at in Italy belongs to the church. That's basically. And that's how Scotland was. That's not quite so much in Italy, but every wealthy place was liable to fall into the hands of the church. People would leave their land to the church for religious reasons. Their consciences would tell them that they hadn't lived very good lives, and they would try and make up for it at their death with their wills. The church gets a bit more land. The church never dies, so she just keeps on gathering in this land and this wealth. And it's estimated that half the wealth of Scotland was in the hands of the Roman Church by the time of the Reformation. Now often this wealth was in the form of entitlements. There were people, not just that they didn't have the money exactly, but they were entitled to the taxes, let's say. And for instance, in Aberdeen, with a population at that time of 4,000, there were somewhere between 110 and 150 endowed clergy. So you've got 4,000 people, quite a small town, smaller than Stornoway, with somewhere between 110 and 150 people who are entitled to a living from you, as it were. You've got to pay the taxes to keep these people. I reckon that's about every tenth man on the street you'd see would be in it, was one of these endowed clergy. And people were becoming weary of this. When the Bishop of Murray demanded his tithe from David Straton, who lived somewhere near Montrose, had a fisherman working for him near Montrose. And Straton sent back a message to him. He told his men to put every tenth fish back into the water, and he sent a message to the Bishop of Murray to say that if he wanted his tithe, if he wanted his tenth, it was but reason that he might come and receive it where he got the stock. to get it for himself. And for this, he was charged with heresy and was eventually put to death, as we'll say more about him later. But that indicates the restlessness that there was. People getting weary of having to pay their money to the Church of Rome. In 1559, Knox's rascal multitude, as he called them, he didn't approve of this, but they sacked the Grey Friars Monastery in Perth. We'll say more about this later. Knox calls it the Grey Thieves Monastery in his history. And he gives an account of what they found in the monastery when they sacked it. Now it doesn't seem very much to us, and I'll tell you what it is in a moment, but it does show us from the way Knox describes it. You can see how poor people were and how annoyed they were getting at these fat priests who had everything and the food and all the rest of it. So here's Knox's description of the Grey Friars. He says, "In very deed, the Grey Friars was a place so well provided that unless honest men had seen the same, we would have feared to have reported what provision they had. Their sheets, blankets, beds and covers were such as no earl in Scotland hath the better. Their napery, that's their table linen, was fine. There were but 8 persons in the convent, and yet they had 8 puncheons, that's 8 large barrels of salt beef." And Knox says, "Consider the time of year, the 11th of May." So this is a time when they would have used up all their winter reserves, and they still had 8 barrels of salt beef left. They were so wealthy by the standards of the time. Wine, beer, ale. The very poor people, the sort of food is significant to them, and this monastery, which had been, which they had last broken into, had all this food in, so the spoil was committed to the poor. So the Church of Rome had all the wealth, or half the wealth, and this wealth had 2 effects. One was that it attracted ambitious people into the church in pursuit of it. If you were wanted to get ahead and be rich and powerful, well, the most successful way was to go into the church, which of course didn't help the purity of the church at all. It was getting increasingly corrupt. But it also meant that there was a growing resentment against the church, not only among the poor, as we've been describing, but also among the nobility, because they were jealous of these people. They had their hereditary power and land, and these churchmen were becoming more and more dangerous rivals to them. And this resentment among the nobility was another major factor in the Reformation. Now, in this book on the Reformation, Haythorn enlists 7 features of the pre-Reformation church. Now, I want to go quickly through these 7 features. Depravity, immorality, that's the first one. Depravity, ignorance, irreverence, the conferring of benefices on inappropriate people, wicked people, children, and so on. Credulity, imposture, and rapacity, that's purgatory and things like that. So we'll go through them, the 7, just reasonably quickly, some of them. So these are the 7 features of the church at that time. The first one was depravity. I don't want to say too much on this for obvious reasons. Hay Fanning gives a list of the children of the Romish priests in Scotland who were legitimated between 1529 and 1559. Now remember that Roman priests were not allowed to marry. So these were the children that they'd had who were legally declared to be legitimate. And there's a record kept, and Hay Fanning gives the list as an appendix. It occupies 23 pages, that's about 300 cases, or about 10 children a year. Well, Scotland wasn't a particularly big country, but it's quite that's the recorded cases of children. So it gives you some idea of the immorality of these priests. Rome insists on celibacy. Priests may not marry, which is unscriptural and wrong. Peter was married, remember, the Apostle Peter. And there were many laws passed, or the Church of Rome was aware of this problem, and they passed laws against the immoral behaviour of priests. But the problem was that there was no one to enforce these laws, because the problem went from the highest to the lowest. They were all guilty, or there were people in all ranks who were guilty. Same time as this was happening, there was at least one priest put to death in 1534 for getting married. He wasn't allowed to get married, but got put to death if he got married, but not put to death for immoral behaviour. And another priest, another married priest who was bricked up between two walls in order to kill him, but he was helped to escape by his brother. So that was the first thing, the church was depraved. Secondly, ignorance. Church, there was a widespread ignorance, a profound ignorance in the church. A few of the bishops were highly educated men, but some even of the bishops were gravely ignorant. Generally the bishops would be more learned people. But for many of the clergy, their knowledge of scripture and doctrine was minimal. Some could not even read fluently. In 1551, Archbishop Hamilton was trying to reform the Church of Rome and issued his catechism to try to improve the state of learning. And the accompanying statute ordered that they were to practice their reading before they read out the catechism. The said rectors, vicars, or curates, must not go into the pulpit without due preparation, but they must prepare themselves with all zeal and assiduity for the task of reading in public, by constant, frequent, and daily rehearsal of the lesson to be read, lest they expose themselves to the ridicule of their hearers, when, through want of preparation, they stammer and stumble in mid-course reading. It's a statute for the reading out of the catechism in the church. So these priests were not even able to read very well. In 1551, there was a survey by Bishop Hooper in the Diocese of Gloucester in England. Now, this was in England, admittedly, but there's no reason to think that things were any different or any better in Scotland. So he had 373 ministers in his diocese. 62 were absent, so that's about a sixth of them were absent, probably because they had more than one living somewhere else. They just took the money from wherever they were in Gloucester, but actually lived somewhere else. That left 311. Who protested them on the Ten Commandments, the Apostles' Creed, and the Lord's Prayer? His examination for the Ten Commandments was, for the commandments, that is, how many are there, where are they found, and can you repeat them from memory? How many, where are they found, can you repeat them? For the creed, what are the articles of the Christian, say what the articles of the Christian faith are, and confirm them from Scripture. And for the Lord's Prayer, repeat the petitions from memory, state how it is known to be the Lord's Prayer, and where it is to be found. Now of this 311, 90 did well or fairly well on the examination. 171 could not repeat the Ten Commandments. 33 could not tell in which chapter they were found. So to me that's a surprising number that could tell in which chapter they were found, but more than half of them couldn't repeat it, couldn't repeat the 10 of them. 10 could not repeat the Lord's Prayer. 30 could not tell where it was found. 9 could not repeat the Creed. 308, so almost all of them, could not prove the articles of Scripture, though some of them could prove some of the articles. And one wonders how Church of England and Church of Scotland ministers would fare now if they were confronted suddenly with the having to say what the Ten Commandments were. Just one other example of ignorance, or one other that I noted, was that when John Knox was in Berwick, we'll hear about that later, the vicar of Berwick, the Church of England vicar of Berwick, was said of him that it was uncertain whether he could say the Lord's Prayer in either English or Latin. So these were very ignorant men. The most famous case of ignorance, however, was one of the priests who's quoted by the contemporary historian of the period, George Buchanan. This priest said, Martin Luther had lately composed a wicked book called the New Testament, but they, for their part, would adhere to the Old Testament. And a Swiss monk said that a new language had been invented some time ago called Greek, which has been the mother of all these heresies. A book printed in this language called the New Testament, which contains many dangerous things. Another language is now forming, the Hebrew. And whoever learns it immediately becomes a Jew. So these are extreme cases. They make the point of just the sort of state of learning in the Church of Rome before the Reformation. If the clergy were ignorant, the people were even more so. In a document signed in Aberdeen in 1530 by 35 of the leading men, 8 could not sign their names. Eight of the 35 could not sign their names. And even in the Scottish Parliament in 1554, there were men who could not sign their names. That's the ignorance, that was the second thing. Thirdly, very briefly, was the irreverence. Just one example. At the end of December, or middle of December, the custom was to appoint boy bishops. They'd have a sort of relaxation, they'd have a boy bishop, and then at the end of the period of holidays, the boy bishop that they'd appointed would preach a sermon. Well, we see the same sort of thing today, the same sort of approach to religion in things like animal services, jokes, clowns, and so on. So that was a prominent feature of the pre-Reformation Church, the irreverent approach to religion. Fourthly, the conferring of benefices. So this is if you want to be an archbishop or all the other positions that there were in the church, how did you get it? Well, they were given to whoever could get them. In 1514, for instance, the Archbishop of St. Andrews, which was, I think, the main archbishopric in Scotland, the previous archbishop had been killed at the Battle of Flodden. What was he doing there? He was killed at the Battle of Flodden, and there were three men vying for the position. And the first one, Gavin Douglas, took possession of St. Andrew's Castle, which was the bishop's palace. That was his way of trying to get the position. The second one, John Hepburn, besieged the castle and captured it. But it was the third one, Andrew Foreman, who went to the Pope, and he got the gift of the benefice from the Pope. And so he was the eventual winner. But having got it from the Pope, he then still had to get the palace of John Hepburn. Often these positions were bestowed on children. For example, James V. There's a letter from James V to the Pope, which survives, in which he requests ecclesiastical positions for his three illegitimate children, who at that time were aged somewhere around the age of 5 or 6. He got these bishoprics for them. And another example, Patrick Hamilton, the well-known martyr, he became the abbot of Ferne Abbey when he was 13. So that all these powerful positions were simply for money. These were religious positions, supposed to be the gospel ministers, and they were being given away for money and for power. Now take the fifth and the sixth ones together. That's the credulity and the imposture. Credulity, the absurd miracles, and imposture, the false miracles. Now just for one example of the sort of false miracle that was about before the Reformation, there was a well in Kilwinning which sometimes remarkably produced blood instead of water. And the mystery was solved in 1826 when they were excavating and they found a pipe which led down to this well from the monastery. It played downhill to the well, so whenever they wanted the miracle, they killed a sheep and poured the blood down the pipe and it came out at the well. And there are many examples of that sort. So to see credulity and imposture combined together, you think about the relics that were so numerous at the time. Scotland was not as rich in relics as some countries were. In the vicinity of Genoa, for instance, in Italy, in a small area, you could find the tail of the ass on which Christ rode into Jerusalem, the rope with which Judas hanged himself, the pieces of silver with which he betrayed our Lord, the saddle of one of the three kings, and the marble table on which Abraham had been about to sacrifice Isaac. Well, Scotland wasn't as abundant in relics as Italy was, but it did have the arm of St. Andrew in St. Andrews, the arm of St. Giles in Edinburgh, and three separate fragments of the true cross in different places. And well, people who either claim the genuineness of these things or believe the genuineness of these things are not in a good position to discern the truth or to declare the truth to others. So credulity and imposture. And then finally, for the pre-Reformation Church, rapacity, the desire to make money out of the church. One of the leading instruments was purgatory, the fear of death, the fear of hell, the fear of purgatory, and that was the thought that people who died, I suppose that's the way it goes really, the thought that people who have died are now in purgatory, and if you'd only give money, you could possibly help to get them out of purgatory. Latimer called it purgatory pick purse. Purgatory pick purse. That was one way in which the church was continually raising money. Another one that was a problem in Scotland was what was called the corpse presence. That when someone died, the priest was entitled to various things. He was entitled to a cow, and he's entitled to a coat. A good coat. There were other people who had rights too when there was a death. And these death duties could be ruinous. In his poem, which is called The Satire of the Three Estates, which was written at the time, David Lindsay gives an account of a pauper who had been able to support his aged parents, and his wife and family until calamity came upon him. His troubles began when his father died. The landlord claimed the grey mare. He had a grey mare and he had three cows. The landlord claimed the grey mare on the strength of the old man dying. The vicar took the best cow. His mother happened to die a day or two later. The vicar came and took away the second cow. And the poor man's wife was so upset at these various losses that she mourned continually until at last she died of sorrow as well. Whereupon the vicar returned and took the last cow and the man's coat. So the bereaved man in the poem had nothing to do but to go with his children and beg bread. That was a fictitious story, but obviously it was near enough the truth to highlight the truth. So these are some of the most glaring faults of the pre-Reformation Church, and they show how utterly corrupt it was. And there have been various attempts to reform the church, but they were far too superficial and too feeble to get anywhere. Some of the bishops were more enlightened, and that, when we describe these things, we're not saying that everybody in the church was like that. That wasn't the case. There was, an Aberdeen bishop, Bishop Elphinstone, who founded King's College in Aberdeen. He's generally highly regarded for his learning and his morality and his public spirit and so on. We wouldn't commend his doctrine, but he was an honourable man in that compared to these other people. But the point is that the problems of the Church of Rome were beyond being reformed. Attempts were made to reform these corruptions, but they were too deep and they were too entrenched for reformation. And this is what the reformers, Luther and Zwingli and others, Knox, realised. Initially you say, well, let's try and reform this church, but they realised that if the corruption is from the very highest downwards, then you can't reform, and that the only thing to do was to separate, come out from among them and be separate. So this brings us on, secondly, to the events leading to the Reformation. That's what the church was like, why there was a need of reformation, and here then is something of what led up to the Reformation. The dawn of the Reformation in the whole of Europe was John Wycliffe in England, who died in 1384, so that's nearly 200 years before the Scottish Reformation. He died, his followers were called Lollards, and there were some of these up in Scotland. One of the earliest martyr for the Reformed faith in Scotland was an Englishman called James Resby, who was burned at Perth in 1407, some follower of John Wycliffe. I don't think anything much else is known about him. And then a little bit later, a Bohemian. You remember that the Reformation, after Wycliffe, it passes over to Bohemia and John Huss, and there was a Bohemian called Paul Kroll, who was a follower of Huss and who was burned at St. Andrews in 1433. But the Lollard movement continued in Scotland, and there is a surviving manuscript Wycliffe Bible. Wycliffe and his followers had translated the Bible into early English, and this manuscript dates from about 1520, and it's used down in Ayr by a man, Murdoch Nisbet, who incidentally could obviously read, unlike to many of these priests. And that's already starting to show the difference between the reformed and the not reformed. Luther nailed his 95 theses to the door of Wittenberg in 1517. The first sign of the Reformation proper in Scotland, so the events leading up to this great work in 1560, the sort of first thing that's on record, is an act of Parliament, I think it was, in 1525, relating to Aberdeen. There was a prohibition on the importing of Lutheran books. These things were coming in from Germany, and Aberdeen port on that side, a lot of trade with Germany and Scandinavia, so they were not to import any more of these books. Well, that would not be a successful statute at all. There was a Frenchman, I forgot to take a note of his name, I think it's Latour or something like this, who he was over with the French forces. There was a lot of interaction between France and Scotland, and he was spreading Lutheran doctrine and was burnt in Paris as a result of that, and he's the first martyr of the sort of Reformation period, just a few months before Patrick Hamilton was martyred in St. Andrews, 29th of February 1528. So there's Latour and Patrick Hamilton. Patrick Hamilton, you remember, it was said of him that his reek infected all on whom it blew. The smoke of this burning, this martyrdom, spread the gospel, the Lutheran doctrine, and many people started to think as a consequence of his death. One subsequent martyr was the man that we mentioned earlier on, David Straton, who had refused to pay the tithe, said the bishop could get the fish out of the sea himself. He was a man who had no religion up to that point. He was notorious for his irreligion, but being accused of heresy because he wouldn't pay the tithe, that was a heretical act, he started to become interested in religion, and it happened that his brother was connected with the Reformed, and he got his brother to read the Bible to him. He was blessed to him, he was converted, he professed Protestant principles. When he went to answer before the council in Holyrood, apart from the fish, he was now actually a Protestant. He was, in their terms, a heretic. He boldly declared what he believed, and he was condemned as a heretic, and he was burnt in August 1534. 1543, George Wishart returned from the continent, I think it was, came back to Scotland, big preaching tour around Dundee and in the south, and he was martyred at St. Andrews in 1546. And the great significance of George Wishart, apart from other things, is that it was at that time that John Knox was converted. So that's about 1544, say. Now in 1547, Henry VIII died in England, and Edward VI came to the throne. Edward VI, Protestant, so you've got England next door, which is now a Protestant country for the space of 5 years. So this obviously was a great help to Protestantism in Scotland, and men like John Knox and others could find a safe haven in England, and all the interaction between England and Scotland at that time. So the work of the gospel was advancing continually among the common people. Here's an account that a Swiss visitor to Berwick gave at that time, contrasting England and Scotland. He says, "There appears to be great firmness and no little religion among the people of Scotland. But in the chiefs of that nation, one could see little else but cruelty and ignorance." So in Scotland, the chiefs are cruel and ignorant. The people seem to have favour through religion, rightly persuaded, whereas the contrary thing was the case in England. Among the English, the ruling powers are virtuous and godly, but the people have, for a long time, been contumacious. I'll just skip that quotation because I see time's going past quickly. And I want to say that the Reformation continued to advance in Scotland, notwithstanding the opposition from above, these rulers. In 1555, there was a highly important preaching tour from Knox, which he persuaded many who had been attending the Mass. They met privately, but they then would go to Mass as well. They met privately for the Gospel, and then went to the Mass, and he persuaded them that they were not to do that. Now, I wanted to read you an account of the tumult at St. Giles in Edinburgh in 1558. This gives an idea of the rising up of Protestantism in Edinburgh. There was an image of St. Giles, Sancti Gili in Knox's language, which was carried around in a procession. And the previous image had been stolen by some Protestants and had been drowned in the North Lock, where Prince's Street Gardens are now, and then had been burnt. But the papists borrowed another one. And here's Knox's account of the procession, which he entitles The Tragedy of Sancti Gili. He says, a marmoset idol was borrowed from the greyfriars, it's the new Sancti Gili, and was fast fixed with iron nails upon a furter, upon a barrow. There assembled priors, priests, friars, canons, and rotten papists, with tabors, trumpets, banners, and bagpipes. And who was there to lead the ring but the Queen Regent herself, with all her shavelings for the honour of that feast. West about it goes, and comes down the high street to the Canon Cross. The Queen Regent dined that day in Sandy Carpenter's house, betwixt the bows, the gates, and so when the idol returned back again, she left it and passed into her dinner. The hearts of the brethren were wondrously inflamed, and seeing such abominations so manifestly maintained, were decreed to be avenged. They were divided in several companies, whereof not one knew of another. Immediately after the Queen was entered into the lodging, some of those that were of the enterprise drew nigh to the idol, as willing to help bear him. And getting the furter upon their shoulders, they began to shudder, thinking that thereby the idol should have fallen. But that was provided and prevented by the iron nails, as we have said. And so began one to cry, "Down with the idol, down with it!" And so without delay it was pulled down. Some opposition made the priests patrons at first, but they saw the feebleness of their god. For one took him by the heels, and dabbing his head to the calcy, that's the pavement, they left Dagon without head or hands, and said, "Fie upon thee, thou young Sancti Gili, thy father would have carried four such blows." This considered, we say, the priests and friars fled faster than they did at Pinkie Cloop, at the Battle of Pinkie, which had been a few years earlier. There might have been seen so sudden an affray as seldom has been seen among that sort of men within this realm. For down goes the cross, off goes the surplice, round caps, corner with the crowns, the grey friars gape, the black friars blue, the priest panted and fled, and happy was he that first got to his house. For such and sudden fray came there never among the generation of antichrists within this realm before. Knox then gives an account of what a certain merry Englishman said when he saw them running. Not very respectable. And then he says, the Queen Regent laid this up among her other mementos, till she might have seen the proper time to have it avenged. Search was made for the doers, but none could be apprehended. For the brethren assembled themselves in such sort, in companies singing psalms and praising God, that the proudest of the enemies were astonished. So you can see, this is the sort of spirit that the Queen Regent and others having to contend with among the people. Now, Mary, after Edward, you've got Mary on Tudor, Bloody Mary on the throne in England with the persecution there. But she died in November 1558, and that marked the end of Roman Catholic power in England, and that soon afterwards it was starting to crumble in Scotland as well. John Knox returned to Scotland from Geneva on the 2nd of May, 1559, momentous day. A few days later, the 11th of May, those monasteries in Perth were sacked by the rascal multitude. In June 1559, following a sermon by Knox, the town of St. Andrews removed all the monuments of idolatry, By September, there were Protestant congregations in Edinburgh, St Andrews, Dundee, Perth, Stirling, Brechin, Montrose and Ayr. There was a church session already operating in St Andrews by October 1559. Dave Fleming points out that it was dealing with, one of the cases they dealt with was a case of divorce, and they summoned a woman from Denmark who deserted her husband 35 years previously. Shows the sort of established nature of religion in St Andrews. The Dundee Council passed an act prohibiting anyone to speak against the reformed minister. So all this happened before the legal establishment of Reformation. While these things were happening, you can in fact legally be put to death for impugning the Pope's authority. And then everything came to head in 1560. The French army, which the Queen Regent had brought in to try and hold down this Reformation, the French army had been defeated. Eventually, Queen Elizabeth was persuaded to send an army up from England. The French army was very strong and dangerous, but eventually she realised that if Scotland remained Roman Catholic, this was a menace to England, and she sent an English army came. The French army eventually surrendered, and there was the Treaty of Edinburgh, 6th of July, 1560. The French troops left on the 15th of July. The Parliament met on the 1st of August, 1560. They ratified the Scots Confession of Faith on the 17th of August. And on the 24th of August, 1560, they abolished the papal authority in Scotland and made the Mass illegal. Well, that brings us then to Scotland transformed by the Reformation. So I want to say a few things about it. Now, the Scottish Reformation was firstly a legal Reformation. The Mass was abolished, Pope's authority was gone, it was now free to meet, to preach the Gospel, to assemble, and this is something of great importance. The Church had a legal right to meet, to preach the Gospel without persecution or hindrance, and it was also more than that, it was entitled now to financial support from the state. That's a great advantage if you're free to meet and you actually recognise and indeed have some money to preserve your buildings and pay for your ministers. So that was an open door to the Gospel in Scotland, which Satan has been trying to close ever since. So firstly you have a legal Reformation, but secondly you have also a spiritual Reformation. There was above everything a mighty work of the Holy Spirit accompanying all this. We do not have numbers, obviously, but it's evident that multitudes must have been converted in the years before 1560 just to give impetus to this work and to keep it going. And similarly, there must have been many converted after 1560 because the work did continue. And without this revival of religion, there would have been no Reformation. They might have a sort of temporary legal Reformation, sort of thing perhaps in a way that you see in some of the, perhaps in the Bible, in some that a ruler may bring about a sort of temporary change in a nation. But unless there are many people converted at the same time, that cannot be permanent. So there was a legal Reformation, there was a spiritual Reformation, and there was also I can't think of a good word for it, but a societal Reformation, a change in society. It's really, in a way, what I think of as the Reformation. A reformed country is one where society has been changed by true Christianity. Well, that's what happened in Scotland. The fundamental issue, I think, is people's attitude towards their fellow men. Thou shalt love thy neighbour as thyself. How do you regard your fellow men? Do you regard them as people that you're to take advantage of, or as people to whom you owe a duty? Do you have a duty, a God-given duty, to try and help others, or not? So where there is widespread dishonesty, so an example when a lack of honesty, when people are not don't have a feel a duty towards others. Lying, cheating, stealing, bribery, whether you've got widespread dishonesty, then enormous resources have to be consumed in policing these things, and also in protecting, people have to use their resources in protecting their rights
and their property. And when society becomes sufficiently corrupt, there are many things that you can't do any longer. You can't operate a democracy when society is too corrupt. So the Reformation brought this change of attitude towards others, which continues in Britain to this day. And I want to give one illustration of this. Now, Mary of Guise, the little guy, I'm not sure how you pronounce it, Mary of Guise, maybe, the Queen Regent. Before the Reformation, two of the reformers reminded her of a promise that she had made, promises. And her response was, "It becometh not subjects to burden their princes with promises further than it pleaseth them to keep the same." I've made these promises, she wasn't denying that she'd made them, but it doesn't become subjects to burden their princes with reminders of these promises more than it pleases the princes to keep them. That's all. A promise serves its purpose because it shut you up at the time, but it doesn't bring any obligation whatever on the Queen Regent to keep it subsequently. So that's the sort of morality that was around before. Now, you think of what a difference between that and 1561, when Mary, Queen of Scots, came to Scotland with a tiny retinue. Protestant country, Protestant religion established, a Roman Catholic queen comes back with a tiny retinue of followers. And one French Huguenot writer observed, 100 years later, "If any Protestant king or queen had gone to a Roman Catholic country, then, or at any time in the following 100 years, with a similar retinue, what would have happened? He would undoubtedly have been imprisoned, compelled to recant, and put to death if he refused." That was their sense of duty towards their monarch, towards a non-Roman Catholic, was simply to persecute them to death. But Mary was accepted. She was the lawful queen. She was obeyed in lawful things because of this sense of duty that these people had towards God. And you see very much the same spirit of the Spanish Armada when ships were wrecked on the Scottish coast, and the Spanish soldiers and sailors were astonished at the kindness that they had received, because they knew that Scottish soldiers would not have received the same compassion if they had been wrecked off Spain. So that's the main thing, is the change in people's attitude towards one another. And there are various sort of supplementary things. One big change was in education. Knox was very keen on trying to improve the standards of education. The first book of discipline, which was published at 1560, was drawn up in 1560, the aim was to have a school in every parish, a grammar school in every town, three or four universities, and compulsory education. People weren't allowed to grow up ignorant. So the whole country was to be educated. And the whole difficulty was to get the funding to pay for this. These teachers in every parish and keep these grammar schools going, because the nobles, there was lots of church money, the nobles were trying to grab it for themselves, and the reformers had great difficulty in getting money for their educational program. But they had some success, and for centuries thereafter, Scotland had a reputation as a highly educated country. So you've got the change in morality, you've got the education. Another thing was the industry, in the sense of people being industrious. One of the errors of Rome was the idea that a truly godly person must live in a monastery or a nunnery. If you're godly, you go into a monastery. If you're not in a monastery, if you're not a monk or a nun, you're spiritually second rate, and therefore you're not expected to live a particularly upright life. And if you're not expected to live a particularly upright life, well, you're very unlikely to do so. Even less likely to do so, one might say. But the Reformation reintroduced the biblical idea that people can and must be godly in ordinary life. And they glorify God by working hard, not slothful in business, but fervent in spirit, serving the Lord. So what a change. Instead of everybody going off to monasteries or else remaining and being corrupt, now you've got people working hard at their jobs in a religious way. So this made a big difference to the nation. industry, a big reform in marriage and morality. One of the problems before the Reformation was divorce, or rather the annulment of marriage, because the Church of Rome had extended the Levitical laws of affinity or consanguinity, you can't marry or whatever it is, all these various laws, they extended these things to the fourth degree. So if you had the same great-grandparents, you weren't allowed to marry anyone who had the same great-grandparents as you, nor if there'd been an illicit union, not a marriage, but something immoral thing, if you were still connected with them in the fourth degree, you weren't allowed to get married, nor if there'd been an engagement which had been broken off, that sort of counted as a marriage for these purposes. So too did godparents. And when you put all these things together, you've got a much smaller population, you've got people with big families, often with several wives in a row because of mortality. So you put the whole thing together, and it became very difficult to find someone that you were allowed to marry. And also, because public records were so poor, how do you know who's the fourth cousin of your godfather or something? So you don't know, therefore, whether these people did not know whether they were legally married. And papal dispensations could, of course, be obtained for a fee to get round the problem. If you wanted to marry someone, you could do so with a dispensation. But if anyone wanted to terminate a marriage, all they had to do was find some connection somewhere that invalidated the marriage, and that was it. It was annulled. So marriage was in complete disarray, and the reformers swept all these laws away and reinstituted biblical laws. And the one other thing to mention is the Kirk Sessions, which started to meet, as we mentioned, at St. Andrews, 1559, 1560. They set themselves to try and ensure the moral behaviour of the people, and the Kirk Session records are full of cases of immorality and adultery. And historians tend to make fun of these things, and this shows that the Kirk Sessions were just obsessed with this subject. But the fact is that if you're trying to reform people's behaviour, this is a subject that will come up a lot. And that is why the session records record these cases, that's what they were dealing with considerable success. So the result of all this was that the Reformation brought an immense change and an immense blessing to Scotland, and we are enjoying the fruit of it to this day. And when one hears or sees of the state of many other countries, one realises how much blessing we owe to the Reformation. And this is why it is appropriate that we should remember the Reformation with thankfulness to God in this 450th anniversary year. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Somerset.